Welcome to the Your Gateway to Wealth and Fulfillment podcast. I'm Andrew Kittleson, advisor at UBS Financial Services with Gateway Wealth Management. We're located in Charlotte, North Carolina. It can be reached at 704-362-8260. I'd like to welcome our guests today, Larry Ostema with Sun Energy One and Ryan Kennedy with Adam Power. I've known both of you for a long time. You're in somewhat similar spaces, in my mind anyways. So looking forward to the conversation. Like to hear a little bit about you, kind of where you started. We'll start with you, Ryan, kind of your path to being, you know, the CEO of Adam Power and what Adam Power does.
Yeah, appreciate it, Andrew, and thanks for having me on here. So yeah, Ryan Kennedy, co-founder and right now co-CEO, Adam Power. I'm co-CEO with our other co-founder, Dennis. And a quick background on that is about 30 years ago, I started in the power distribution space overall. So that was in need of a job out of high school, basically. I didn't do so well in high school, so I needed a job. And at the time, you know, college was sort of the pinnacle of getting a good job before the trades became more important like they are today. So found a job as an electrical or electrician helper, and then worked the construction for about 6 years, became licensed and very familiar with the electrical industry. At that time, I really saw that I was very interested in the design of buildings and some of the stuff that went in buildings, electrically speaking. So I decided to go to college and work full-time, went to UNC Charlotte, and then graduated with an electrical engineering degree, and then worked for a design build contractor for about 10 years after that on the electrical space. So focused on like critical facilities and things like that. So overall, about 30 years in nothing but electricity, pretty much the only thing I know. And then founded Adam Power in 2014 with co-founder Dennis Karousis. And the idea of the company, which still holds true today, was that if you look at all of the electrical systems out there on the planet, they have some, as complex as it may seem, they actually have a lot of commonalities. And one of them is that pretty much ahead of everything that uses electricity, you have these things called circuit breakers. That's whether you're in a house or in a commercial building, industrial, it really doesn't matter. Breakers are literally everywhere, but there's something that no one's paid attention to a whole lot, at least since they were first invented, you know, back in the 1800s. And the reason we focus on that is because if you kind of look at the changing in what's required for having, you know, energy monitoring and control over energy flow and things like this, is you have this device that could be the thing that does all the monitoring and control of energy, but being the breaker, but is not. It's just kind of one of those products that had a killer application when it was built, and that was to protect circuits, and it's still the killer application today. So the way we saw that was, is if you could create a circuit breaker that was intelligent, that could be controlled and had monitoring and some level of intelligence, you could do many, many things with that, which I could elaborate on later. And so we founded Adam Power to really try to commercialize what's known as solid state circuit breaker technology. It basically means making the circuit breaker digital. Not a new idea. Others before us had attempted similar things, but no one had really commercialized the technology. In the kind of power distribution world, solid state breakers had been a thing of holy grailness, if you will. And so we set out to do that and were successful in really being the first company to commercialize and ever get a UL listing, you know, on a solid state breaker ever in 2019. Since then, the company's evolved in many different ways. We really apply that today to large-scale electric vehicle charging. So think of panels with our solid-state devices charging vehicles. And that's really, we apply that mostly to the fleet and workplace charging sectors today.
Fascinating. So, and I know you've had a lot of challenges. Anybody starting a company, founding a company, you've got challenges, but 2014 to 2025, 11 years in business, that's a success. So congratulations.
I appreciate it. And it was probably one of the worst business pitches ever in hindsight. You know, it's like, we're going to go into the circuit breaker space and we're going to build a new one. And if you know anything about breakers, it's a very old industry that's very established, highly regulated, and it's hardware. So it's not like the best investor pitch, you know, and definitely something very difficult to do. But we're happy happen to be really pioneers in that space.
Well, good. Well, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about that journey and your place in the market. But Larry Ostema, Sun Energy One, I mean, I know you started out as an attorney, corporate attorney. You have a ton of experience, but now have made a move. Tell us about kind of your career, where you started, and how you got to where you are now, and what you do at Sun Energy One, and you know, Sun Energy One's place in the solar industry.
Great. Thanks, Andrew, and also appreciate the opportunity to be here. So I started practicing law in 92, had done a two-year stint investment banking before law school, and knew I wanted to be on the transactional side. But it wasn't until moving to Colorado in 94 that I really started focusing on energy. And when I say energy, most of it's been in the power sector. So very similar to Ryan's background, working on issues that pertain to electricity generation, distribution, and consumption. The beginning of my career, when you look at the different technologies that were getting invested in and popular, for the first 4 years, all we did was help one particular U.S. utility and its unregulated business develop coal plants in Latin America. And then a wind project came in eastern Colorado. I happened to be, you know, a young associate working on it, and then another one. And after that, started gravitating to renewable energy, because that's most of what the new power that we were seeing going into the ground came from renewables. At the time, it was mainly wind, some hydro repowering, and then solar was very early on. We were seeing biomass and other types of technologies. But then really in about 2007, 2008, solar took over as the dominant new generation source in renewables to start to catch up to wind and others. So moved to North Carolina in 2007, right about when the state tax credit was in place in the Carolinas or in North Carolina. The Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard has recently been implemented and signed into law. So North Carolina just saw an explosion and very quickly became the second highest installed state in the country for solar. Now I think it's still in the top four or five. And a lot of that was smaller projects, typically 5 megawatts, which powers about 1,500 homes for frame of reference, 5 megawatt projects that were being sold either to the predominant utilities in North Carolina or the power from those projects was being sold. So did a lot working on the structuring and financing of those projects. Then some companies started to realize that they could go outside of the traditional regulated market in North Carolina, still have the benefit of some of the incentives, but sell power to anyone they wanted to. And that's, there's a deregulated portion of North Carolina in the northeast part of the state that is part of a company that manages the grid in the Mid-Atlantic called PJM. And that area allowed these companies to start having much larger projects, selling them to universities, to corporations, the power from these projects. And one of my clients, Sun Energy One, where I'm now employed, was really one of the first to go after that market and to start selling power to third parties, not just the utilities. And these projects grew from 5 megawatts to 50, 80, 200. Now, if it's less than 200, a lot of these developers won't even look at them. So these are very large projects. They typically are 1,500 acres or more of land, and they are truly power plants, not just incremental additional power for very local uses. So then about a little over 10 years ago, I joined the law firm Nelson Mullins here in Charlotte and co-headed their energy group. And we grew it to focus on a lot of the regulatory initiatives that were coming in into the Southeast, the expansion of the solar market outside of North Carolina around the country, electric vehicle charging. I was fortunate to have met Ryan early on in his development of Adam Power. He used to represent Adam Power and in their growth, which has been phenomenal. and also saw a lot of other technologies kind of start and then stop. Biomass is falling out of favor again for a number of reasons. There could be a resurgence. There have been some other technologies in, you know, specialized batteries that didn't necessarily pan out. But for the most part, we're seeing now a concentration of capital being invested in solar, to some extent wind, but more solar, electric vehicle charging networks, and other electric vehicle battery manufacturing, as well as batteries that are used to support the grid in fairly established technologies. And so that's the marketplace we're seeing. And then about a year and a half ago, I joined Sun Energy One, which had been my biggest client for 5 or 6 years. And we're now looking to develop out, to sell, to build the utility scale projects that we have around the country. We recently announced a partnership with a large asset management group. We're selling them 6 projects, building them for them. We're looking to expand into other markets, other regional transmission operators around the country, and get back to our core, really, which was building. We started off building a lot of power plants for Duke Energy, some for Dominion, some for other large independent power producers, and we're getting back to that model while maintaining our own development and balancing that out, not just being a pure IPP or independent power producer. So we're excited. We think that the market right now for power is tremendous opportunity. You hear a lot in the news about a lot of the demand for power, and we can go into that here in a bit, but it's multifaceted. We believe it is politically agnostic. We think a lot of it is coming no matter what. How it gets balanced with different fuel sources could certainly be impacted by policy, but the United States is in for a great ride of a lot of capital being invested into the power grid. And when you think about the power grid and step back for a moment, the power grid in the United States is the largest machine in the world, period. And it was the beginning of it, and some of it that is still in existence is over 100 years old. So the grid needs a lot of work, a lot of maintenance, taking it just like breakers with Atom Power from purely analog and mechanical to digital. We're seeing that transition in the grid, and it's going to require a lot of investment capital.
So ton of demand. When we hear about the demand coming from AI and data centers, and it's amazing that it's such a large component of the economy, our grid and energy. And that's mind-blowing, Ryan, that you say these circuit breakers were first developed in the 1800s, and they really have not evolved much from them until you all built this solid-state circuit breaker. And, you know, Larry, you're talking about the need for a massive amount of energy. Seems like a huge opportunity, but also, how do we meet that challenge?
There's no silver bullet for any of it, really. I mean, because the grid is, you know, Larry mentioned, it's pretty big, you know, and it starts off big and ends up little by the time you get down to the home or the commercial building. I think there's like a few things. I mean, certainly one is in generating power to meet the need, which Larry could probably speak to better than I could about that. And then on the other hand, there's this general need to figure out how to really better manage energy fundamentally at the edge of the grid, like through things like, I mean, there's always been programs out there like demand response, you know, to where you could, you know, shed load at the edge of the grid, you know, which will be necessary even as we go further into this high energy world we're in or going into. But there's probably more smarter things we can do managing energy so that it's not disruptive to the user and actually has value to those producing power. In other words, our focus on the breaker side and really at the edge of the grid side of things, you know, we think about that a lot. This as well, EV charging is one of those. Is there's problems with the grid if everyone were to electrify all of their vehicles today. You know what I mean? Because of just how the transformers are distributed and wire and things like that on the distribution side of the grid. So a good way to address that is just to have, you know, chargers and maybe even the vehicles themselves sort of talk to each other along the way and figure out how to better charge across a bigger type of network, you know? So you don't like overload the grid at once. In other words, if all those chargers were going to put, say, 50 gigawatts on the grid at once, if they were all plugged in, maybe you have something more smart, you know, at the edge of the grid that says, well, we can actually sort of do something smarter and still get everyone charged, but not necessarily blindly do it all at once, you know, which is sort of the case today. That's where I kind of focus on is the, you know, what can we do at the discrete circuit level at the edge of the grid many, many times over, you know, to help address, you know, maybe not getting all the generation we need up front, you know, to power the things we're talking about.
Yeah, I would just say on the generation side, some of the numbers, and let me just not rattle off figures, but maybe try to give some context to them. So electric vehicles alone, if the current trend of adding, and this is not only full electric vehicles, but also hybrid electric vehicles, the power consumption from the cars that are currently estimated to be added to the U.S. auto fleet by 2030, that represents about another 50 gigawatts of power demand. So when those cars are charging, that is new capacity that we need to add to the U.S. power grid and to our generating capacity that just doesn't exist right now. So it would be effectively, this is new power plants going in to support EV growth. Data centers is a huge number. The estimates are plus or minus, but generally they fall into a range of over 270 gigawatts of power just for data centers. There was one recently announced data center in the Southeast that the data center, a single data center, was going to be requiring 2,500 megawatts of power. And again, to give you some context, 1,000 megawatts is a very large coal plant or your typical nuclear power plant. So more than 2.5 nuclear power plants just to power one data center. And AI, one of the reasons for the increased demand for power is that if you were to ask or you know, enter a Google search on your computer versus asking ChatGPT the same type of question, the AI search is much more intensive and requires at least 10 times the amount of power to come back with an answer versus your traditional Google search. And those numbers are only increasing as AI gets more complex. And we were talking before this podcast started that really AI in its current iteration is just an incredibly deep, incredibly complex series of search algorithms. And that takes a huge amount of power, and that power is only increasing. So the data center demand, I think, is very real. The EV demand is coming online, and then manufacturing, whether it was the former administration, the current administration, you know, there's a big interest and we're seeing a big resurgence in U.S. manufacturing. Well, those plants need new power to support their operations. That number, the estimates are around 50 gigawatts. So if you think about just those three sectors, forgetting homes and other businesses and other types of load, just electric vehicles, manufacturing, data centers, and then the fact that we're still estimating to retire about 70 gigawatts of coal plants by 2030 in the U.S., that's more than 450 gigawatts of new power plants need to come online. That's more than $600 billion of capital investment. That's going to come from a mix of natural gas. It's going to come from solar, probably a little bit of wind, fair amount of batteries supporting it, but there may be one or two with small modular nuclear reactors, which is an up-and-coming technology that's getting a lot of interest, but it's still quite a few years out from something that we would see more than one or two plants a year coming online because it's still a long process to get those nuclear power plants sited and approved. But that is going to come primarily from gas and solar and going to require a huge amount of investment in this country. So that's what we're focused on with Sun Energy One. We are a utility scale solar developer with battery solutions. So we're looking to the opportunity to put in a lot more solar to feed that growth, as well as supporting companies behind the meter, because sometimes the grid just can't support it. If you're in certain parts of this country and you want to put in a new data center or a manufacturing facility that has a big power need, the utilities cannot necessarily support it. And so if you can't bring your own power, you need to wait years to get your plant approved. So we see an opportunity behind the meter with these customers, as well as just selling into the grid itself. So we think that the amount of capital getting committed to the U.S. for this market is just mind-boggling, but is absolutely happening today.
Wow. Those numbers are mind-boggling. So the different sources of power, whether you're talking LNG or solar or nuclear, to get the same gigawatts, and you guys are starting to talk over my head, but to get the same number of gigawatts, say, from each of those power sources or power plants, how long would it take? I mean, you use the number of gigawatts. How long would it take to build a nuclear power plant, solar farm or solar power plant, LNG facility to meet those needs?
Well, you know, let's say you've got approval to interconnect to the grid, or you have an opportunity to sell power directly in markets that allow this to the user of that power, whether it's a data center or manufacturing facility. If you were ready to go at that point, you would be looking at air permit, you know, conditional use permit / building permits, construction permits at the local level, and getting your financing in place, and then deploying the capital, doing the construction. It's usually about a 2 to 2.5 year process. Now, if you're saying we want to find a greenfield project, whether it's gas or solar, really any other technology for generation, and sell into the grid, in a lot of parts of the country, it's a 6-year process just to get approval to sell into the grid. And then you would start your other permits and your other capital raising efforts, because you really need to just wait that amount of time, because the grid operators, whether it's a utility in a regulated state or one of these independent operators in these other territories, they need to look at all the new generation that is proposing to come on, the generation that exists, the load for that area, and then what's coming offline through retirement, and balance what is the requirement for transmission upgrades or other things. And so that takes a little while. We believe it takes longer than it needs to, but it is a process that can be expedited, but is still an important function that you have to make sure that the investments in the grid are smart. You're putting the power where it needs to be, where it should be, where it helps the overall grid and ultimately our economy. And so we're seeing big opportunities behind the meter to shorten some of that cycle and also alleviate some of the pressure on the transmission system. And if you have a manufacturing facility in a state that's really transmission constrained, and a lot more power is coming on and taxing that transmission system, the utilities are going to build more transmission because they need to, and pass that cost on to you. So even if you're a business owner owning a manufacturing facility and you don't need more power, you're not changing your load profile, it can impact you from a cost perspective. Some of these decisions that are being made at the state and federal level. So it's very important we plan it right and we execute correctly on this. But it is coming, is the simple message. We're building a huge amount in the last couple of years, and it's going to continue. I think the mix is probably going to go a little bit more to natural gas than might have been under the previous administration. But other than that, the amount of power is probably about the same, regardless of the political winds.
What do you see, Ryan? So the demand from EV, the time it takes to get plugged into the grid, is that slowing the adoption of EV vehicles and building out of the EV infrastructure? What's the connection there between what Larry's talking about and what you see at Adam Power?
Yeah, we haven't really seen that be the deciding factor in most cases, like directly. In other words, we haven't heard like, hey, there's just not enough power, we can't service you. Instead, the growth that Larry's talking about is related to the things that you actually have to purchase to accommodate that growth, like transformers and switchgear and stuff like that. So what we have seen, though, is that projects get delayed because the transformers are being allocated elsewhere for this grid growth, right? In other words, as they're trying to up whatever utility it is, as they're trying to give you capacity, they're also upgrading their own grid. And so you're kind of like indirectly waiting on them, you know, to provide transformers because they're allocated to other growth sectors. You know what I'm saying? So it's not like they're saying we simply don't have enough power. They're saying that we don't have the transformers, as a very good real example, or switchgear or something like that, or substation, right? Because they're busy with those products elsewhere. You know what I mean? And you're like 10th down on the list. So the project gets delayed because of that. You know, so it's In other words, you can look at the power lines ahead or below the ground and say, yep, they're there, but then they have to transform or provide a substation or something for that. And those are being allocated in other directions. So you have to get in a, you have to wait a while in a lot of cases, not every case, but in a lot of cases. But actually, one thing I want to follow up on was, you know, I was thinking about this problem several years ago in that it's kind of like this perfect storm in a way. And Larry can certainly correct me on this, but on the grid side of, or in the generation side of things, it almost feels like there's this perfect storm of you have essentially a reduction in baseload generation, you know, by not a whole lot more nuclear being built and coal plants being decommissioned, while at the same time you have this opposite growth in energy consumption pretty much happening at the same time. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, some plants, the retirement date is getting extended a bit, and some plants are seeking, you know, relicensing that would have otherwise been retired. But, you know, again, it's just economics. But yes, overall, we are at a power crunch risk if we don't address this.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's kind of two things we can do, and that is increase generation. But that probably won't be in and of itself the be-all solution, because there's probably not that much generation we could produce that quickly. So there needs to be this equivalent intelligent load and energy management on the edge of the grid in parallel with some increase in generation. So we sit on both sides of that equation, you know, the generation side and then the behind the grid side on my side, or behind the meter, I would say, you know, edge of the grid. And I think that's a good combo. And it's a really good way to think about it, which is, assume we can't produce all the power we need for this growth that Larry's talking about, but we can produce some level of it. We as just a country in general. But to sort of help that is the more and more like intelligent energy management we can have, particularly in the EV side of things, which is probably the easiest one to provide energy management profiles for. That's a good combination. You know what I mean?
Why is EV easier to do that with?
Well, because electric vehicles, electric vehicle charging is kind of neat in a sense that when you plug some, you know, a plug into a car, you're communicating with it. It's not just giving it power. It does give it power, the charger, but it's also communicating with it. And one of the things it can communicate to the vehicle is how fast to charge. And so that's kind of neat because you can actually just modulize the charge rate of the vehicle from the charger. And so you multiply that out across lots of chargers, and then you have a pretty powerful, you know, energy and load management tool, you know, given the power density of electric vehicles.
Right. Okay. So is that something like if I'm going to a supercharger because I'm on a trip and I need to charge my car versus it's plugged into my garage overnight and it can be charged overnight, so it doesn't need to be done as quickly?
Yeah, the vast majority of charging is done level two, but specifically I would call it destination charging, you know, like home or workplace or hotel, something like this, you know. That's going to be, or even fleet, you consider that destination charging to some degree. It's basically when the vehicle sits there for some time period. That's the majority of charging. Percentage-wise, I don't know, but it feels like 90% is probably destination charging. And so that's also going to be the bulk of your power consumption as well related to EV charging, you know. And so that gives you a prime opportunity to do smarter things, you know, to not just drop all the energy into the vehicle and instead make it more smart. For example, a good example is workplace charging, by the way. This gets, because we have many workplace charging applications out there. Once you start talking to, because a lot of customers don't really know the energy management side of this, you know, so it's kind of like, well, we want to put out enough chargers effectively or put enough power in to charge all the cars full power. Why? Because the perception is that, well, you just need all the power, you know, to charge the cars. But if you kind of look at it, it's like, well, if you do the math, and you could equate this to a fleet market as well. If you do the math, it's like, well, they drive average in the U.S. of about 38 miles round trip a day. So if you just round that up and you say, well, they drive 20 miles to work, what's the real goal? The real goal is to fill them back up for what they spent going to work. So 20 miles. And once you start doing that math, it's like, well, you could do that in about 0.6 hours with level two charging. So therefore, you can reduce that energy substantially and instead charge them across the span of, say, 4 to 5 hours. You know what I mean? Multiply that out across effectively all level two, you could do the same thing with. And that's a pretty big reduction in energy consumption, at least instantaneous energy consumption, which is the bigger problem. It's not so much the amount of energy so much as it is the amount of power required at any given time. The problem is everyone plugging at once and just full board charging. That's the problem, you know, and that affects the base load generation issue we were just talking about, you know, is that all of a sudden you put this big load on the grid and it's difficult to accommodate that, you know?
Yeah. And I do think Ryan's making really important point that, you know, when I mentioned earlier, the grid being the largest machine in the world and a lot of it very antiquated, as it becomes digital, as it can take two-way communication, as products like Atom Power's interface and allow that two-way communication, we can get a lot more efficiencies. And efficiency at the end of the day is just dollars saved, right? So the best electron saved is the electron you didn't need to use. And so if we can have tools where the sectors in the U.S. that are not yet optimally efficient, and that would be primarily residential, commercial, and now this two-way communication enabled in energy management, there's huge opportunities for cost savings and allowing us to allocate those dollars elsewhere. Industrial, we are among the leaders in the world in efficiency in industrial production. Our energy production per unit of materials produced is the best, or if not one of the best in the country. And especially if our gas prices stay low, natural gas prices stay low, a lot of that will continue. But efficiency in the industrial sector has been achieved for the most part, but we really see some opportunities in commercial and residential. And I think that plays very well into the whole demand side management that Ryan's talking about.
Okay. Is that taking some of the strategies or technology in the industrial sector and bringing them into the residential? I know maybe your circuit breaker, we're talking about the EV charging stations, but, or poles, systems, but does that tie into the circuit breakers?
Yeah. I mean, because I mentioned, like, the EV charging is one of the most elegant forms of energy management because you can throttle the vehicle itself. There's other forms of doing that from breakers, like HVAC demand. Depending on the HVAC system, it's a little less elegant, this is kind of what Nest does, you know, at the thermostat level in the residence, but you can do equivalent things in commercial, residential, industrial, as well as do load shedding, but in a smart way, I would say. And the problem is where breakers can come into this much more easy, I would say, is that, like I said, demand load shedding, at least at the customer level, is nothing new. The problem has been that there's not been this very easy way to implement it. Because, for example, if a utility, say, most utilities have some sort of demand response, they call it demand response, so like load shedding, you know, capability. Most of the time that comes in the form of HVAC and hot water. So hot water is one of those that pulls a lot of power, you know. I think the residential sector overall is 35% of the grid load, effectively. Hot water is probably half of that. Just rough estimate. Obviously, it depends on what part of the country you're in, but it's about half because they have about 5 kilowatts per heater, you know. And so that has a huge opportunity, like EV charging, to, if you could throttle that down. The problem is like, well, now you have to get into someone's house and now you have to like rewire stuff and now you have to do all this stuff. Whereas if you just changed a breaker to a smart breaker, that's a whole lot easier, you know. So scale that out to commercial industrial sectors as well. It becomes very easy now to implement those demand response programs. That's kind of how we see the future of this, at least within our company, which is to be able to keep focusing on the breaker, because that's the easiest thing to go and change out or make smart than trying to rewire stuff and put different devices in and intercept wiring and stuff like that. The beauty of the breaker is, from a systems level, it has the real estate kind of advantage of location, location, location. You know, it's always going to be there and it intercepts all flow of energy. You know, so if you just replace one with another that's much smarter, then all of a sudden you have this capability you otherwise didn't have without having to rewire stuff. That's Atom Power's ultimate vision for the company and for the technology. We're not quite there yet because we're not able to replace every breaker out there, but that's our ultimate goal, is to get to that point where breakers become something that are easily switched out or provided as highly intelligent, you know, controlling devices.
Okay. So if it's digital, I imagine that comes with software and you're able to potentially control it with a device, your phone or something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah, you could. You could. I don't know that most people really want to do that, to be honest with you, because most people don't really want to think about breakers. From a software perspective, though, I see a different play in the sense of companies producing energy, being able to tie in and have intercommunication to make intelligent load balancing decisions, and it be transparent to you as the user and not disrupt you. So you're kind of like putting something smart in that a customer could interface with or a consumer could interface with, but at the same time, you're also providing a device that maybe they don't realize is actually helping their energy costs by performing load management.
Okay. Larry, going back to the solar power, and you mentioned, if I heard you correctly, it takes about 2.5 years to get that, to get something developed if it's not being pulled from the grid. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
Correct, right. There's a separate time requirement and procedure for getting approval to even export power to the grid. But just to export to a load center, you're looking probably 2 to 2.5 years.
Okay. So if you had all the capital and something was done to compress that time, what would be the biggest challenge to getting as much of this up and running? Is it components that fit into these?
Well, great question. And, you know, the headwinds at this moment are multifaceted and very much international, right? So we have, in the very short term, in February of 2025, as we're sitting here today, some uncertainty on tariffs that could or could not impact some of the equipment in any of these plants, whether it's natural gas or solar or other technology. So with uncertainty, that becomes risk allocation discussions and, you know, some capital pullback until there is some certainty there. So that's one issue on the tariffs. There is currently the possibility that the Inflation Reduction Act may have either a partial repeal or a full repeal that would impact a lot of the tax credits and, again, allocation of capital and which type of technology would be receiving most of the influx of the new dollars. So that's out there. But the other things that people don't often think about is, you know, Ryan was alluding earlier to the transformer side and some of the difficulty in procuring transformers. For a number of reasons, the United States does not manufacture nearly the number of transformers we used to. A lot of it is coming from offshore, some of it from China. And there is a big demand and a competing demand from other markets around the world, including the Ukraine. Their power grid has been almost destroyed. So as they're now looking to rebuild, they are creating a large demand for a lot of this equipment that's going there that would otherwise have been available for other applications. So, you know, there's some unintended or not necessarily readily apparent areas where it's causing some bottlenecks. But overall, I think, you know, the tariff issue will flesh itself out. A lot of the tariffs that are impacting, for example, solar came into existence in the first Trump administration, but what not a lot of people realize is the Biden administration kept them in place. So these tariffs have been in place for 6-7 years now, and so the market has adapted to it. And as long as we have some certainty, then, you know, it'll be fine because we can price it in and then people will make capital allocation decisions. So overall, I think it's like any other market. Capital wants to flow where there's some certainty of return. And the less certainty, the higher reward they need to take on that risk. And so if our capital costs go up, we may need to pull back on a couple of decisions. But as long as there is relative certainty, especially in the short term, that can come together so we can do longer term planning, I don't see really any of these other headwinds as being material. It would be maybe project by project with a couple of delays or a couple of cost issues. But overall, the market growth, where we're going, there's just too much that is outside of policy that's driving this market.
Hmm. Kind of same thing on your side, Ryan. Do you feel like the terms of policy or, you know, access to the components you need to build what you build?
Policy has definitely affected at least the EV charging business, not necessarily for us, you know, because it depends on where you focused when the EV charging kind of market started picking up, you know. certainly, you know, disruptions in the NEVI funding or, you know, the IRA.
So let me pause you right. What's NEVI funding and IRA?
So the NEVI is the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Act, Larry?
I believe so.
Okay. It's part of the IRA, right? The Inflation Reduction Act. Yeah. So I think disruptions in that could certainly disrupt some in the space. Maybe some, you know, end users as well who are looking to benefit from that. But I would say, generally speaking, though, for our sectors, primarily being commercial fleet, private companies, effectively, is it's they're transitioning that regardless. You know, you could actually say the same with a lot of the municipals out there that are electrifying their own fleets. It seems to be, as far as we can tell, relatively independent of some of those. The ball's in motion, basically, regardless of the funding that's available from, you know, the federal government. Seems to be the case. You know, but there's other sectors where they're entirely dependent on that. We don't play in those spaces, but, you know, others do, but those are definitely affected. So it kind of depends. You know, EV charging is a very broad term. You know, it can mean a lot of different things depending on where you're at. But for our markets, we haven't seen, we see it as like, yeah, the ball's rolling. You know, regardless, there's, you know, the fleets are electrifying. They've, you know, started this process years ago and continue to do so. And yeah, I mean, and maybe in some, there's a slowdown because of some of the things we mentioned, like transformers, you know, being a high, you know, lead time item, delayed projects, but not necessarily, you know, slowed down outside of, you know, delaying the project itself.
Yeah. And again, some of the, let me just maybe come numbers from not the generation side, but the demand side. So everyone, again, is talking about AI and data centers, but in a couple of markets, it is huge. So in Virginia, more than 20% of every electron being consumed from the power grid is going to a data center. 20% just for data centers. North Carolina has a large concentration of data centers, and the utility here, Duke Energy, was very proactive about 18 years ago, courting some of them. There's some very attractive rates under the tariff schedules they have. So we have a large amount of demand from data centers. And as a country, the number was about 3% just a couple of years ago. By the end of this year, most estimates, it would be about 7% of all electricity produced in this country is consumed by data centers. So when you think about 4%, basically the doubling of a market in just a handful of years, I mean, we can't think of precedent in recent history. And in the 30 odd years I've been in the power sector, we've had growth that was 1-2% a year. It was stagnant. It was negative. It was stagnant again. And so for, you know, 20 years of my career until just a couple of years ago, load growth or the amount of electricity being consumed in the U.S. was pretty flat. A lot of it because of industrial efficiency and other efficiency measures. But for the most part, there just wasn't a huge new area of growth. This is generational change. Southern Company, in their recent filing, announced that they had underestimated the amount of load growth by a factor of 17 in their territory. So it is all over the country, and it is real. And I know we're going to achieve the challenge of implementing it, but it's just got to be done smartly so the grid doesn't become overloaded and unintended costs are passed on to people that don't expect it.
Ryan, you brought up fleet charging. So I think when a lot of people think of electric vehicle charging, we think of the Tesla charging stations, but that's not the market that you all are in. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. Well, most of our market's in fleet. That goes into a couple of different categories. Municipal fleets are one of them, you know, so that's going to be, you know, police, fire, you know, waste management, things like that. That's kind of in its own category, I would say. And then we have last mile delivery fleet. Those are kind of two bigger sectors, municipal and then last mile delivery. And so last mile, what you would think of as the truck that delivers something to your home or business. Those are what are getting really electrified first in the fleet sector. Semis are definitely coming, you know, but it seems to be where most of the fleets are focused today that at least have programs to electrify is on that last mile delivery. And so it's a sweet spot to be in because for multiple reasons. I mean, both commercially, but also for implementing some intelligent energy management, because they have predictable routes, they have predictable dwell times, they're at the hub, you know, and you can get by with level two charging, you know, for the vast majority of the applications, which is far less cost, you know, than say DC fast charging, which are the, you know, Tesla supercharger stations. And so, yeah, it's a little different. We call the, you know, the supercharger network, we call the electric highway charging, you know, and that's where we don't focus. So on those fleet side, we focus on where the vehicles are, yeah, going to be parked and going to need to charge, whether it's overnight or during the day, you know, for some time period. And that amounts to a lot of ports, you know, per hub, you know, for us. Instead of like a few big ports, there's a whole bunch of little ports, and that's our business.
Okay. Are we electrifying fleets faster than consumer vehicles? What's adopting electric vehicles faster?
Yeah, I think it's still in the consumer market, you know, and will be for some time. You know, there's a faster adoption there. And it's largely, and I said for some time, I don't know when that inflection will, if that'll change like rapidly necessarily, but largely because the fleet vehicle selection is there's few. There's very, very fewer fleet vehicles that are electric than there are consumer or passenger vehicles that are electric. So you only have a few to choose from, you know, if you're in the fleet markets. So there's not a wide variety of vehicles today. You know, I think that's going to change, but there's sort of a potential bottleneck in electrifying a fleet fast is that you have very few vehicles to choose from, you know.
Pivoting, Larry, back to you, your career and Sun Energy One now, you started out as an attorney. What has that been like, you know, to go from attorney to in the C-suite at a large solar company?
Well, I'm not going to claim that I never look at a contract anymore, but for the most part, you know, we have great in-house and outside counsel, so it frees me up to really look at development opportunities. So whether it's our partnership with the asset management company that I mentioned that has been a great relationship, the opportunities to maybe modify our model to be more direct and do third-party construction of these type of projects for other owners, as well as the behind-the-meter application where we're really providing a power service. You know, the one thing I haven't mentioned yet that I think is really important that is something that we're seeing more and more is it's not only power that needs to be delivered. Many still of the consumers of power still are very concerned that it be as high a renewable percentage or at least, you know, emission-free as possible. But ultimately, it's about power. But what isn't necessarily always focused on, at least in the mainstream press, is it's also about power quality. You have to have reliable power that's being delivered, ideally at a reasonable price. And, you know, but the reliability of that power is something that we're very focused on, which is why we're supplementing it with hybrid solutions like batteries and also some other possible thermal generation assets. Because, you know, for example, I was involved with a transaction at a manufacturing company in the paper industry several years ago, and they were at the very end of a transmission line that was already pretty loaded. And when they occasionally got a blip, if they had a 50 millisecond or greater loss of power, their machine tripped off, and it's this huge spool, like four-story building of one holding a spool, basically a paper. And the thing would have to be reset, all of the paper cleaned up that was no longer efficiently wound, and they would have, you know, this huge downtime. They told us it cost over $300,000 for them every time there was a single blip on the grid. And to avoid some of those power quality issues really saves money, increases our manufacturing capability. It gives us competitive advantage as a country. So, you know, there's a lot to doing this smartly, which is what I've emphasized a couple times in my comments, is if we can connect to the right places and deliver the right type of power at a high quality, you know, I think then that's the solution that this country needs.
Great point. Ryan, coming back to you, as a founder of a company that's been around for 11 years now, if you can take yourself back, am I right? 11 years it's been?
About that? Not quite, almost okay. 11 years. Yeah.
maybe for anyone else out there thinking about, and I would consider your product disruptive, you're disrupting the industry a bit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, definitely.
For somebody who's got an idea to bring to market, what was the catalyst, I guess, to bring it from idea to, I'm going to start a company and go after this and go after this market? Is there any advice that you give to anybody?
Well, I mean, there's like a technical catalyst, but then there's, I think what you're probably asking more, if someone wants to go do something like this, then what would be the, number one advice I would give? No, actually, in the energy space we're talking about is actually a very hard space, first of all. You know, it's a hard space to play in because it has to do with physical things. So specific to the energy sector, to start a business or a company here, first of all, no, it's extraordinarily difficult because you're dealing with dangerous things often. You're dealing with hardware, not just software, things like that. And that requires, and I would say this is probably going to be applicable to anybody starting a business, it requires an incredible amount of pain threshold and and persistence. You know what I mean? Because, and the reason I'm saying this is because, again, I'm kind of tailoring this towards the energy sector because of it, the nature of it. And Larry and me have certainly seen a lot of companies. I think you kind of mentioned some, you know, or not the companies, but the, just generally, you'll see a lot of companies not be successful in the energy sector because of the difficulty and because it can be so, it can be perceived as overwhelmingly difficult, if not impossible to overcome. You know, so if you think about it, like Atom Power, for example, is a good example of this. This is why I mentioned, if you look back hindsight, it seems like one of the worst ideas. You know, it's like, hey, not from a technical level, but from a business level. It's like, okay, so we're going to make a new hardware product that's life safety, highly regulated, in a sector dominated by basically four companies across the globe for over a century each. You know, it's like, not a good idea, right? But if you really, you know, we believe then, you know, like we do today and into the future, that it's for a very good and useful purpose and could change a lot of things related to not just energy management, but safety and flexibility and all these things. If you really believe that, then it just takes being able to stomach the amount of failures you're going to run across along the way, you know, and failing in hardware is more difficult to stomach than probably anything else because you have to do a lot more work to overcome, you know, some of those. And I mean, failure in the sense of, you know, as you're building, things don't work right day one. You know, you have to go and iterate and rebuild and rebuild and rebuild and retest and retest and retest, you know. And it takes a lot. And this is the thing, it's not necessarily about being the smartest, in my opinion, not about being necessarily the smartest person in the world to do some of these things. It's more about persistence and being able to take pain, you know, and see failure over and over again. And then eventually succeed and then fail again and succeed. Yeah. So that's a lot of what I've seen, at least for companies, for entrepreneurs that start companies in the energy sector. I believe it is a fundamentally different animal than probably any other sector because of the nature of it, typically dealing with dangerous things and hardware and heavily regulated things as well. It's like all the worst combinations in one.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of hurdles to get over for sure.
Yeah.
I appreciate the conversation, guys. Are there any questions that I should have asked that I had not asked or anything you want to close with before we wrap it up today?
I would say the thing I would like to close on is what we've talked about in this conversation actually is something, you know, that's been on my mind for quite some time, which is truly this interesting collision, if you will, of I believe, you know, what Larry was saying. I think we're in a once in a lifetime event here with the increase in energy consumption that we're in, you know, and if you collide that with this, generally speaking, base load reduction in the grid, it's a big, big challenge to be overcome. That can be for sure. And there needs to be a lot more energy, not to pun that, but energy on this subject to get it right. You know, so that's why we're here, but on a different level, I would say, than Larry and his team. You know, we're at the edge of the grid. There's things to do there. There's things to do on the generation side as well. And it's actually a bigger problem, I think most people would realize, is that, you know, the amount of energy that we are going to be consuming here and are right now and will be in the next 4 years even is pretty substantial. It's unlike, it'd be good to see a chart of that, Larry, by the way. Cause yeah, he's right. He's like, I remember back in the day when we were going through in commercial space replacing fluorescence with LEDs, you know, and it's a lot of people are like, well, I mean, how much difference is that gonna make? It's not like we need to shed a lot of energy per se, and energy's cheap and all that. And this is, you know, 20 years ago, and now it's much, much different. Yeah. Much, much higher growth of energy than power generation we've probably ever seen in consumption. Anyway, all that's to say is it's an interesting time that I think is probably a once in a lifetime event, you know, with what we're going through right now in the energy sector.
Yeah, I would definitely echo that. And the other just final comment that I would like to relay to the listeners is really just more of an excitement broadly for the economy. I mean, if we're going to be looking at 450 gigawatts or 600 billion of investment into power generation and the grid in the United States over the next 5-6 years, I just want to give you a couple more thoughts. So we just completed this is probably our smallest project, an 80 megawatt project. So much smaller than some of the others that we do and some of our fellow developers. That project at its peak was employing 600 people every single day. I was just out at one of our projects that's about to start in a very rural community. That community's tax base is very constrained. We're going to add over $1 million a year to their tax rolls just because of the property taxes related to the installation of the solar equipment in their county. So when you look at what the impact is going to be for employment, for great jobs in the trades, for, you know, the opportunities for counties to have additional revenue streams, for farmers to have additional revenue streams. You know, I mentioned a lot of these projects are 1,500 acres or higher. Well, in discussions with the farmers and where the market is now, leasing to a generating company is in many ways the best possible return they can have compared to other farming activities. And then it's guaranteed because they have a rental stream for 40 years in most cases from a high credit worthy entity. So, you know, it helps strengthen the local economy. It helps strengthen the trades, manufacturing. And, you know, I think that overall, this demand and this challenge that we're facing over the next 5, 10+ years, if we do it right, is going to be a boon to a lot of sectors.
Massive challenge, and you all are meeting it. We appreciate it. I mean, as an end user of energy, I don't think often about this, probably like a lot of us. So appreciate the work the two of you are doing. And it's great to see a lot of this come out of North Carolina. And if anybody wants to get in touch with you or find you, you're both on LinkedIn, right? And Sun Energy One, right? The numeral one, and Adam Power. Ryan Kennedy, Larry Ostema, thank you so much for taking the time today. I'm looking forward to doing this again. Hopefully we can do a Future of Energy 2.0 somewhere down the road.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks for having us.
Have a great day, guys.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.